John C. Knapp, PhD, is an internationally known consultant, speaker, and author with leadership experience spanning the education, business, and nonprofit sectors. He served as a college president for 11 years, most recently at Washington and Jefferson College, where he led innovative initiatives to enhance the student experience and strengthen competitiveness in the market. Under his leadership, the college received record philanthropic support and recruited the largest new class in its history. He also has directed academic programs and ethical leadership at several universities and has worked with many corporate leaders to establish a nonprofit executive education center, helping hundreds of business people and professional firms address really sticky ethical challenges that you're going to hear about in the episode. Earlier in his career, John served as president of a firm providing services in executive communication and crisis management to leading corporate, professional, and academic clients. He has written or edited 5 books and numerous articles and served as director of a conclave of global higher education, a retreat for university presidents from all over the world. So many more accolades that I don't even have time to go into, but you will hear and learn so much from listening to John, who has had a fascinating career moving through these different worlds of communications consulting, ethical leadership, presidencies of large institutions, and how he's taken all that and developed it and used his strengths as a quiet, thoughtful, innovative leader to really make a difference. And he's so kind in saying that the introverted leader helped him on his journey in getting started with embracing his own introversion. So without further ado, let me turn over the mic to my friend, Dr. John C. Knapp, PhD. Welcome, John C. Knapp, PhD. May I call you John?
I wish you would.
Now, I want to tell folks, a lot of my guests I meet this way, but you really struck me as somebody I met through, I believe, LinkedIn a number of years ago. And I saw that you were kind of commenting on posts and making some really insightful, you had some insightful thoughts that you were sharing about introversion. So it was curious to me about your knowledge of this as a senior leader, because usually I would say to people several years ago, I couldn't get it on the radar of people that were in a leadership, in senior leadership positions in their organizations. So maybe we could just start out with that, like a little bit about how you became aware of this topic of quiet leadership or introversion. You were kind of before a lot of other folks did. And welcome, by the way.
You were before a lot of other folks. And in fact, I read your book, The Introverted Leader, back when it came out and found it to be really helpful and kind of affirming of the fact that leadership has nothing to do with whether we're introverts or extroverts, that we can all be good at this and we have different strengths to play and different challenges perhaps to overcome. I think the first time I became aware of sort of being an introvert was a program I participated in. It was one of those leadership development programs. I think it was might have been through the Regional Leadership Institute in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And they did a Myers-Briggs type indicator. And my Myers-Briggs type was INTP. And didn't mean a lot to me, but the facilitator, who was a psychologist, began to explain what the different types meant and what you might learn about yourself. And as I listened to him, I thought, that sounds a lot like me. And it helped me to sort of own the idea that this is probably the way I'm hardwired. I've actually done that same assessment about 4 times over the years, and it always turns out the same. Okay. I know some people say it changes over time. For me, it really hasn't.
Yeah.
But I found it useful enough that when I was running my consulting business in Atlanta, I actually brought the same psychologist in to do an exercise with my team. Mm-hmm. And so we had 15 or 20 people there, and everybody had done the test in advance. And he had not shared with me anything about what he had learned. But when he came into the room, he began to describe the dynamics of our meetings. And he would say, you know, which one is Jennifer? Uh-huh. Well, you know, Jennifer, you're the one that always does this in a meeting. You know, and I was floored. And everybody said, well, you obviously talked with him in advance and set this up. And I said, no, actually, I didn't tell him anything, but he nailed it. And so it really helped our group to begin to appreciate the differences and why it is that one person would sit and predictably say nothing until the end of the conversation, for example. And so that was useful. And I saw the value then in the diversity of personality types that might exist in a workplace. And I tried to leverage that to make us better performers to the extent that I could. I was told years ago that the INTP personality type, Myers-Briggs, is the most common type among college professors. That happened to be my type. I wasn't interested in going into higher education at the time, but I took that away. And when I did find myself in higher education, I began to recognize that was probably true. There seemed to be a preponderance of introverts who are really drawn to the professoriate because of their interest in things like burying themselves in research. And that's often kind of a lonely task, but it's the nature of the work. But there's an irony in this, that in the higher education space, when we interview people for jobs, whether it's a new professor being hired or a president of a college or university, the interviews are done by committee. And the committee interview probably feels like a wonderful, energizing opportunity for an extrovert. For an introvert, it's not the most comfortable way to go to your first job interview when there are 12 people sitting around the table, all of them prepared to pepper you with questions. And it doesn't mean you lack confidence. It just means that you're feeling out of your element. And then sometimes that interview is followed with, well, we'll continue the interview over dinner. And so we all go out to dinner as a group. And the person being interviewed feels like, you know, they're the pig at the luau. I mean, they're sitting there being asked all these questions, but they're expected to act very naturally and enjoy their dinner. Well, again, I think some people who are more extroverted may find that a really welcome opportunity to interact and have fun. I think for introverts, it's absolutely exhausting. And it's just interesting that in a field where we do tend to interview a lot of people who are by nature introverted, we throw them into a situation that puts them out of their natural element. And by the way, there won't be another occasion in your career besides that where you're sitting around a table as the person who has to answer everybody else's questions in quite that way, you know. So It's not even a very natural way to assess someone.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that can be changed without a lot of trouble, you know, and seeing the corporate side where we had people having to do their demo. It was an R&D situation, and they had to give the example of their you know, what they had created. And that was like at the end of the day, their presentation after these committee interviews, maybe not 12, but they had a lot of people. And so one of the folks that we were talking about this topic said, well, why don't we just keep them that night and have them present it in the morning? And it made such a difference. So it wasn't like, so they paid for one more night, but the person was refreshed and they were on their, in their best,
at their best, yeah.
It's been a long day for me.
In higher education, you'll see that very often for faculty members, they're asked to do a teaching demonstration.
Same kind of thing, yeah.
And sometimes that's sort of an open meeting. Anybody can come and hear this person get up and give a talk or do a presentation. That might go really well, but then if you're an introvert, you feel like you've been wrung out a little bit from that, you know, putting everything into it.
Yeah.
And then the big meetings might follow that.
Follow that, right.
You know, so just and being I know I've spoken all over the world to audiences of all different sizes. I have no problem with that at all. My challenge has often been the after the talk when
let's go
when
out.
People want you to stay around and interact and, yes. and you're like, man, that just took about half of my energy away just doing that last 45 minutes up there on the podium speaking. Yeah.
That's the next frontier. Well, you had such a fascinating background as I was looking over your history and, in terms of being in communications and then having two college presidencies under your belt. You do all this consulting. So you were kind of drawn, it sounds like, John, to communications early on. Like, that's kind of been a theme. And I think it's fascinating because a lot of people who are, let's say, college president, from my understanding, are really more trained in not so much in the human relations aspect, right, of leadership. So I wonder how that impacted you, or maybe talk a little bit about that confluence of the communication and senior leadership and how that either helped you or maybe you also offer challenges.
Yeah, I'm glad we have 6 hours for this podcast, and I'll be glad to tell you all about it.
I guess I didn't do my prep with prepping my guests. No, it's fine.
Well,
go ahead, please.
I began my career as a journalist briefly and then found my way into public relations, actually working with one of the national public relations firms in their Atlanta office. And after a few years, left there and began my own practice. And our specialization was really in crisis communication and issues management, working with large corporations and their leaders when they were facing serious challenges. And I began to really appreciate the challenge of recognizing when a problem is one of your own making. You know, the sort of self-awareness that we need is often eclipsed in the pressure of the moment. And so to me, that began to spark some interest in how do we manage organizations in a way that's consistent with the values that we espouse and make sure that we're attending to the things that matter, that we're not cutting corners, that we're not turning a blind eye to problems that need our attention, but that we remain fully aware of the situation around us, and that we address problems at the time they can be addressed before they become crises or problems that run out of control. And as a result of that, I started thinking that the challenge for many organizations is that we need to establish management practices that align with ethical standards that allow us to lead and manage organizations that not only avoid problems, but actually have certain competitive advantages. And so I went back to graduate school at that point while running the consulting business and finished a PhD where I really bore down on understanding this problem of self-deception in organizations and looking at ethical challenges and how we sometimes blind ourselves to our own failures or our own risks. And I started a nonprofit organization in Atlanta called the Southern Institute for Business and Professional Ethics, which was led by and funded by the corporate leadership in the community. And we put together programs year-round. We had literally hundreds of organizations and thousands of people going through our seminars and discussion groups and trying to learn better how to attend to the ethical dimension of work. And ultimately, we merged the institute with a big university, and I found myself in higher education.
Mm-hmm. And it was actually the university, I didn't mean to interrupt, but that university that you graduated your undergrad in was Georgia State
University. Yes, Georgia State University.
You found a home there.
Yes, and I had not intended to make a career in higher education at that point. I was already enjoying a successful career in consulting and advising organizations around the Southeast. But once I merged the nonprofit organization with the university, I thought maybe I should really focus on this full time. And I did, was called to Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, to start a center for ethics and leadership at their university. And after several years, received a query about serving as president of a college in the state of Michigan. So at that point, became a college president, served as president of two colleges, one in Michigan and one in Pennsylvania. But that's kind of the trajectory. And a lot of this had to do with a belief that I came to over time that we need to begin educating people at a younger age about how to understand and apply high ethical standards to their work and how to develop good practices as leaders, as they emerge as leaders, to be the sort of people that can establish organizational cultures that are ethical in nature as well. So education became a passion.
Yeah. So it was a real, it was a shift for you then to go from consulting and giving teaching these ideas. And I'd love to hear, maybe you could share an example of like how, let's go back to that and unpack it a little bit. So the example of how teaching ethics and working with these companies, what would be an example of something that you might have been able to influence you and your team and change? Because like we really, it's woefully needed right now.
Well, I think, you know, to sort of take that back to the work we were doing in communication consulting, most of our work came to us through big law firms who had clients who had some kind of a problem. And they would call and refer us and say, you know, you probably need some help from these people who can come in and help you with understanding and communicating and answering questions about this thing that has now happened. The nature of that work was coming in after the fact, helping to extinguish a fire that was already burning. And my interest after some time became, how do you get into the fire prevention work? What do you need to do to actually help people develop organizations with values that avoid the kinds of things that can ultimately wreck careers and damage institutions and organizations? And so we dealt with everything from you know, executive misconduct, financial issues, environmental problems, racial discrimination cases. We were involved in product safety, in medical malpractice cases. And in most cases, if you did the postmortem on the problem that that we were working on, you could trace it back to a point in time where that problem could have been prevented, and maybe even the seeds of the problem could have been recognized at a time when it could be dealt with. But it's too often that after the fact, people are trying to solve a problem. And so some of the work that we were doing was simply helping people spend some time learning from their mistakes and saying, how do we go back and think about how we got into this situation to begin with so we can make sure it doesn't happen again, right?
Yeah. And bringing this back to sort of the wiring that you talked about in yourself, and I imagine with some of the other individuals who were probably, I'm sure, deep thinkers. I'm sure you had some, I'm guessing you had some introverts on your teams. What do you think they brought to these leadership consulting roles that was effective? Because these were some, I'm sure, some very complex, sticky problems that you were wading through.
Yeah, what I found, and this may be true in most consulting or even other professional practices like law and even medicine, but it's important to not only listen, but to actually learn. And so going into a new situation, you know, you might be working in a different industry or certainly an organization you're not familiar with, and understanding how to ask good questions and how to do the research you need to do to learn before you jump to conclusions and start offering advice and shooting from the hip. It requires a kind of discipline about not beginning to opine on things too soon, but actually taking in as much information as you can and thinking it through and perhaps doing some additional research before providing some direction to a client that might be looking for that. Sometimes your first impressions are right, but often they're not. So, you know, it's, I think that that's a skill that probably comes more naturally to some of the introverts who are interested in thinking before talking.
Yes. That's well put. That's well put.
One of the things that's unique, I think, about the college presidency as a leadership role is that you probably have more constituencies that are placing demands on you than almost any other CEO position you can think of. You imagine, you know, we had our students and we lived in the middle of campus in the president's house. And so you're living with your customers and you're dealing with your customers' parents. Now, how many CEOs and other businesses have to deal with the parents of their customers?
I hear there are a few these days that are coming in on companies.
There are a few. We did everything we could to push them away. And sometimes they would just come right back. And then you're dealing with not only if you want to think of students as customers, I generally don't think that's appropriate. But if in this case, if you want to use the analogy, you also have to deal with your former customers, because people who are no longer spending money with your business who are no longer sort of active customers, namely your alumni, think that they should have a say-so about everything that goes on, whether they're writing a check or not, you know. And you've got the community to answer to, of course. You've got faculty and staff, and they don't always share the same needs or concerns. And within each of these groups, there are differing opinions on everything under the sun. And so all of this is sort of converging in the office of the president. And the president is in a position where you're adjudicating all sorts of disagreements, and you're finding yourself pulled in a lot of different directions in terms of, you know, what should be the priority. But it's good work. It's rewarding work for sure. And it's really work that has sort of eternal significance in the sense that we're actually helping to shape a generation that in turn can lend their influence to making the world a better place. And, you know, long, far beyond a world that we will even see ourselves, to know that with that influence lives on through the students that we've been able to help mold.
Really interesting. How did you when you think about the teams that you built in those leadership roles, were you cognizant of personality types and, you know, and bringing in some more extroverts on the team to kind of balance it out a little bit? I would imagine that might have been helpful to you. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
It's a good question.
You constructed your teams, you know?
That's a really good question. I think one thing that's In the role of, and I'll just start with the role of college president. In a role of a college president, the day you begin work, the people that work for you are people who were hired by your predecessor. Not surprisingly, chances are you did not come from within the organization. Most college presidents are hired from outside. Rightly or wrongly, that's the way most boards operate. You know, there's always a smarter person outside than whoever's inside. Yeah. You're also working for your predecessor's board, who your predecessor might have had a role in shaping and recruiting, but you don't know these people and they don't know you. And so you land in this environment where one person has picked up and left, you're dropped into that seat, and you might be a very different person from the one who was there before, and nobody's quite prepared for that. You know, you're helping people understand how you're different and sort of who you are and how to relate to you, which might require them to set aside whatever assumptions they had about what the president does and how the president does it and adapt to a new person in the role. I don't think I fully understood the challenge of that in my first college presidency. I probably assumed that people would adapt to me a little more quickly. And I learned that, well, that was kind of hard because I wasn't the person that was there before. And some people certainly seem to think I should be. And one of the challenges in the job in general is that presidents of colleges are assumed to fit certain molds, which includes being an extrovert. Mm-hmm. You know, the college president that shows up at the big event and works the whole room and talks to everybody there and then goes back around, does it again, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, being an introvert.
That was exhausting. I bet that was.
Yeah, it's totally exhausting. You know, being an introvert, that doesn't come naturally to me at all. I can do it, but it's not a natural thing. My tendency after giving a speech would be to go and find someone that really wants to talk to me and get engrossed in a conversation and sometimes needing someone to prod me and say, hey, you better go talk to some other people here. You know, that was something I had to learn how to do, and over time probably got better at it. But, you know, it's sort of a politician's role of kind of working the crowd. I did learn a little trick from a friend who was a university president who's also an introvert. He said, the thing you should do is at the event, get there early, stand at the door and shake everybody's hand as they come in. That way you've touched everyone. You've said hello to everyone. Now nobody can say that they didn't get a chance to speak to you. And that'll cover a lot of that for you as an introvert.
Absolutely.
Actually, my wife and I are both introverts, by the way. And so she and I learned that and began to understand that that's really a nice way to make sure that nobody feels like they were neglected, because we're probably not going to be, you know, working the room. Now, in my second presidency, having learned a bit more about what it's like to start new with a new team, I was much more attentive to not only helping people understand me, but helping me understand them and thinking more about what kind of a team, we have. And so one of the things that I did when I got to Washington and Jefferson College was we did a retreat that summer with the direct reports, and I had each of them develop a kind of a user's manual on themselves, something you mentioned in your latest book, actually.
Yeah.
And, what does somebody need to know about you to work with you well? Mm. And are there some quirks about you that maybe you need to explain up front? Or are there things that are often misunderstood about you? And so it afforded me an opportunity to learn more about them, but also an opportunity for me to say to them, you need to understand that I am an introvert. And that I can be misunderstood in that way at times if it seems like perhaps I'm not as gregarious in situations as somebody might like the president of the college to be. Or you'll find that I go and I like to have time alone in my office to think and work on things. That doesn't mean that I'm trying to withdraw from people. It's just how I get stuff done, you know. During COVID, introverts had an advantage, I think, that, we weren't wilting because of the lack of interaction with lots of people in person. We were probably able in some ways to be at our best and doing good work and bringing it to other people through Zoom or whatever the method was.
I like that you've themed through what I'm hearing is you're not afraid, John, to bring these issues to your team, to talk about what makes you work, like the user manual, et cetera. I was just reading or maybe rereading the dysfunctions of a team. Patrick.
Yes.
Remind me his last name. We know who we're talking about.
I actually have it somewhere in my library here.
Yeah, and I keep remembering the woman who was pushing back all the time. Like, there's always at least one person. So did you ever have a challenge with people not wanting to talk about this touchy-feely stuff or, like, let's move on, or get any resistance about, talking about these communication, interpersonal dynamics?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure I could say that was, a big problem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there were some people that found it a little bit tedious, I guess. I brought in both cases, we did 360s and I brought in someone from the outside to kind of work with us on what are your strengths as a team and how can you help each other be more successful based on what you've learned from the 360. Some people are really threatened by that kind of an assessment. I think it can be done in a way that's not at all threatening and where people understand it's not a performance review. It's just a way of helping all of us learn how to work better together and shore up each other's areas of need and leverage each other's strengths. So then, I can remember a couple of people, one in particular who seemed to really chafe at that and not understand why in the world are we taking time to do this.
Yeah. Hopefully
I guess that's normal. And and sometimes, it's probably helpful to have somebody who's, if you get too far off task on what you call the touchy-feely stuff, it's not bad to have someone in the room that reminds the group, hey, we need to get focused again here.
Mm-hmm. Well, having been a consultant yourself, you have respect for those right people to bring in, right?
Yeah, that's so right.
We were talking before we started recording about a couple of things. One was about meetings. And I know you alluded to the fact that we've got, with COVID, with the virtual meetings, that people tend to sometimes jump to schedule a meeting when it really a conversation on the phone, might work much better. So what are you thinking about that? What are your thoughts about communication now and how with your expertise in that area and where we have some work to do?
Yeah. I'm probably, because of my introverted nature, I'm sort of meeting averse in a lot of ways. Like, do we really have to have a meeting about this, And then there are other people, they just want to have meetings all the time, there's nothing better than another meeting. And something that I've learned is that while you don't need to have a meeting about everything, and sometimes a quick phone call is just as helpful if you're just trying to move on and get something done, there is a lot to be said for the process of engaging people in a decision or giving people a chance to have ownership. Last week on Friday, I was at a university in Tennessee where I was meeting with a leadership team, and I was leading a session with them on developing trust in the workplace. And we were talking about what are the drivers of trust and what are the roles of leaders in actually sort of stoking those fires and keeping the fire burning. And one of the things that has struck me as I've learned more from the research about how we actually develop cultures of trust is that some of what's needed probably doesn't come naturally to people who are inclined to make decisions on their own. So trust-based leadership, trust developing leadership in organizations is in part dependent on engaging other people in making decisions, being consultative, being collaborative, being transparent, meaning taking time to explain things to people. It's not enough to say, here's the decision, go do it. People want to know why, and they want to have time to have input and give feedback. And I think for people who really sort of enjoy the engagement with the group and with others and thrive on that, maybe that aspect of leadership is a little bit easier, but it's something that's necessary. We have to actually give people an opportunity to be heard and to give their input and to understand why we're doing what we're doing. Not just in, you know, small teams, but even within an employee population at large. Uh-huh. And so we were spending time on that and talking about some things that they could learn to do to help engender more trust in the workplace. And one thing that I've found with that is that we're busy. And all of this takes time. And so it's over and above what you need to do to get through the day when you're busy. Taking time to bring people together or to invite more input. You know, it's easy to sort of roll your eyes and say, wow, you know, I know we need to give people a chance to have input, but, you know, don't we already know the answer?
We don't have time.
But yeah. Surprisingly, yeah. We often learn a lot and find out that we didn't have all the answers after all. And we find that we get a lot more buy-in. You know, I can remember doing strategic planning at institutions where maybe I went into it thinking I already knew the direction and knew some answers, but by being patient and really involving the right people and giving people a broad opportunity to participate, including sort of open meetings where people can provide feedback, it's interesting how your own thinking can change if you're listening and understanding that maybe people are seeing this from a perspective you can't possibly have in your role.
Right. And it, as you say, it takes time. And I wonder, added to that, those kind of group discussions and openness, are you somebody that also encourages one-on-one meetings? Because again, I bring it back to the introvert sensibility where people like to go deep one-on-one and they build trust that way. So is that something that you did with your folks or you do now in your consulting as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's essential. And mm-hmm. I've also found that one-on-one meetings are often better, for me anyway, when we're not slavishly tied to an agenda. It's in the one-on-one that a lot of times there's an opportunity for people to sort of be off script and for us to let the conversation organically go in a direction that it needed to go. And so... Mm-hmm. You know, I would ask my direct reports prior to a meeting to let me know the things that they wanted to cover in the meeting. But I would try to manage the meeting in a way that we could just be free flowing. And if we didn't cover everything on the list, if it wasn't urgent, that was fine because, you know, the opportunity to just be one-on-one is a chance sometimes to talk about things that neither of us thought of until we were together, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something else that I think was interesting in your previous comments about learning from a colleague. And I do see you, I watch that you do go to conferences with peers as well. And I really encourage people to do that, to try to really connect with other professionals. Is that something that you would endorse as well?
You know, I've always done that. Going back early in my career, when I was working in Atlanta in the communication business, We would have regular breakfast meetings with a group of us who were direct competitors, and we would compete fiercely sometimes for business, and we would get together and enjoy friendship and talk and share what we've learned and how do you handle this? And let me tell you where I screwed up. What would you have done? And we developed a kind of a level of trust among ourselves, even though we were competitors, you know, and so that as well as participating in the more formal association meetings in the field can be very helpful.
Yes.
And college presidents need this especially because there is no other job quite like it. And no one else that isn't a college president can understand the job in my experience. I think most people would tell you that if they're in the role that, you know, members of your board, maybe CEOs of corporations or heads of law firms or physicians, they really don't understand what you do, even though they may think so. And the people who report to you may be, you know, VPs over different areas of the organization. Mm-hmm. None of them understand what it's like to be in the role where all of that converges in one place. And so developing, you know, attending meetings and being part of organizations with other college presidents was very helpful to me in 11 years in that job. And after a while, I became more of a mentor to some newer people in the role, which was good because mm-hmm. others had done that for me. And you develop the kinds of trust relationships where you can pick up the phone and call someone in a pinch and say, I'm trying to figure this out. What would you do?
Right.
And it gives you a kind of a support network that can only be people who do the same job you do, I think.
And I like, you know, what was the subtext there is mentoring relationships, and they can come out both ways, right? We can be mentored by less experienced people as well. But I love the fact that you emphasize the informal breakfasts, more formal meetings and encourage that. And introverts can do that very well as well. So just as we kind of move towards the end of our discussion, which has gone really quickly, I wanted to just ask you a couple more things. And one of them has to do with a topic that's probably we read about every day that's on the front page. What are your thoughts about artificial intelligence? Does it come into the roles that you've been playing both on the college campus and ethics? Now in more consulting, where do you say things right now? Any opinions, John, about this?
Well, I have a lot of opinions and just a little bit of knowledge, actually. You talk about bringing people together in groups. Mm-hmm. For 21 years, I have convened a group of college and university presidents from around the world at the University of Oxford over in the United Kingdom. And we call it the Oxford Conclave on Global Higher Education. And we meet in a retreat format. We limit it to about 10 presidents a year. So it's kind of a small invitation-only gathering. And we take hot topics that we're all dealing with and focus on those. And the last 2 years, I've had participants from countries as diverse as, you know, the United States and the UK, but also as, you know, India and Zambia, Uzbekistan, you know, people from a variety of different countries and different cultures who all are trying to figure out how to navigate the speed with which artificial intelligence is redefining so many of our organizations and changing the work that we do. And so we had the opportunity the last 2 years to meet with people at Oxford who've been researching the future of work and, you know, what kinds of jobs are we going to see in the future? Some will become obsolete because of artificial intelligence. There will be new jobs created as a result of it. A lot of the change that's accelerating in the workplace and the nature of work isn't at all related to artificial intelligence, but we all imagine that it must be, you know. And so,
right.
You know, I think we have to adapt quickly. And for colleges and universities, the challenge that's before us is that these are not institutions that have historically been good at changing on a dime. The wheels grind pretty slowly sometimes. And so a lot of times the business world, the world of employment, business and professional life, is adapting to change more quickly than education is. And so the challenge for educators is how do you continue to update and be adaptive and responsive in your curriculum so that what you're offering today is still relevant to someone in the workplace 5 years out, 10 years out. Mm-hmm. This has been something that I think has really encouraged organizations in higher education to become more nimble.
Yes.
And to understand that you can't spend 3 years studying a potential new area of study. You need to find a way to get at it and maybe begin to pilot some new ways of learning and get moving on it. I think for practitioners, artificial intelligence has a different meaning depending on the work that you're doing. Mm-hmm. I just gave a talk up at Clemson University recently on artificial intelligence and the authenticity of leaders. And I focused on the idea of relying on artificial intelligence to communicate for us. In other words, writing the speech you're going to give, writing the memo to your employees. Mm-hmm. You know, today, if you go on, you mentioned LinkedIn, you go on LinkedIn, it will offer to write the post for you.
Right.
Well, I'm not interested in what artificial intelligence has to say. I'm very interested in what Jennifer Konweiler thinks, but I want to know that I'm actually reading your words and your thoughts. And in the same way that if I go to hear a speech somewhere, I'd like to think that the person speaking actually has that expertise and didn't just get AI to gin something up for them. And if I'm leading a group of employees, say as a president of a college or an organization, I want people to hear my voice and to read my words and to understand kind of the tonality and the values that come through in the way that I'm speaking to them. So I think there's a real danger that if we start using artificial intelligence as a crutch, we all start sounding alike. And we fail to communicate or convey to people who we really are in an authentic sense. And so I've had a real interest in that of late and have done a little bit of writing on it. I've done some speaking, but I think it's a challenge because it's so easy when you go on almost any app that's AI enabled today to let AI do the work for you. And along with that, you don't learn anything. If AI does all the work and writes the piece for you, you haven't really done the learning you need to do to go out and read things yourself and you know, discover new sources of information, you know.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we could spend a lot of time on this, but I think from a leadership standpoint, there is this concern about artificial intelligence beginning to sort of homogenize the way that we sound and communicate and really deprive us of that opportunity to convey and project the uniqueness of who we are.
Right. And I hope you will write a piece on this, because I think your expertise in analyzing this through the lens of ethics and I think could be a real contribution to all of us who are struggling with right now how to use AI as a partner but not replace us. And yeah, it's moving all so quickly. So, but I guess the bottom line is every leader needs to be cognizant of what the pitfalls are. I think, is there anything that we haven't covered that you would like to address in terms of any of the topics we talked about? In particular, as we go ahead and look to continue to reshape organizations so they are more inclusive of introverts, extroverts, all personality types, any thoughts about what we need to be doing as a workplace?
I do have one thought, and I've appreciated the way that you have addressed personality types, particularly introversion, extroversion, as dimensions of diversity in a workplace. Mm-hmm. Often we've tended to think of diversity in terms of the things that are visible, race, gender, disability, if it's physical disability, perhaps place of origin, if we can discern that from someone. There are also the unseen ways that we're diverse. And some of those areas are actually more defining of who we are and more important to understand. But our diversity work has often neglected to dig into the sort of unseen dimensions of our identity. And I think we're facing a particular challenge now that we have an administration in Washington that is sort of demonizing the idea of doing work to try to encourage diversity and inclusion in organizations and even penalizing organizations for doing the work. I think it's fundamentally a misunderstanding of what good work on creating an inclusive organization is about. I remember some years back, I spoke at the conference board in New York on religion in the workplace and how do you create a workplace that's accommodating of a variety of religious beliefs without just telling people to park it at the door and that it has no place at work, meaning leave part of yourself in the parking lot. And I remember one of the chief diversity officers there, these were the chief diversity officers of some of the large corporations in the country. One of them said, you know, the unseen parts of diversity, including religious belief, really are the final frontier for us doing this work. Mm-hmm. And I think that is true, that we've got to learn to understand and appreciate the differences that exist among us. And when those aren't visibly apparent, then doing the work of sort of teasing that out and really getting to know people's identity at a deeper level. And, you know, as you know, and I think you referenced, all the research tells us that diverse teams, however you define diversity, people who are unlike each other are much more effective at solving problems than homogeneous teams where people are more or less all alike. But that's only true if we manage the diverse groups and help them understand each other. Otherwise, people don't work well with each other when they're all different. We have to help them understand and appreciate and value the differences that each person is bringing to the table. And so I appreciated the fact that you flagged this as one more dimension of the work we need to do to be fully inclusive and provide an opportunity for everyone to flourish in a workplace as the person that they are.
Well, that means a lot to me, John. It really does. And I would say right back at you that you're the embodiment of someone who's living that and who is not afraid to convene people and really talk about these issues that really do build trust and acceptance of all kinds of people. So I think we make a good team.
Well, I agree. I've certainly enjoyed this conversation with you.
Well, likewise. Just before I let you go, we do have one question we're asking guests this year, and I think I'd like to ask it to you. So you have to leave your house quickly with a small suitcase, and you can only bring one book with you. What is that book going to be, Dr. John Knapp?
Well, the challenge there is that I have Kindle on this thing.
I know.
And I'm carrying a whole library of books.
So all right, well, let's pretend it's a hardback or a paperback.
Well, I'm currently on Kindle, actually. I'm currently reading The Road to Unfreedom by Timothy Snyder, the historian, and really goes back a decade or so ago, but looks at some of the precursors to the rise of authoritarianism that we've seen more recently. Mm-hmm. The hardback book that I just finished reading that I might have carried on a trip, I just finished Leo Tolstoy's Resurrection.
Wow.
Which is not always one of the works of Tolstoy that comes to mind immediately, but it's actually a pretty good read, and there are some aspects of it, particularly in his coming to understand the needs of people who've been imprisoned in Russia because of their not being from there and not having valid passports and things of that nature, that felt a little bit contemporary to me. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the prime thrust of the story, but I enjoyed reading it, and it was in hardback.
That's great. I'll have to amend my question a little bit. Thank you for reminding me. Everybody could bring lots of things. And I appreciate these historical references here, too, because I think that's really important right now that we take that long view. So I want to thank you so much for a really provocative conversation. I think I know our listeners are going to enjoy hearing about your career journey and how you weaved in so many of the concepts of being a strong introverted leader and making a difference. So thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Well, I want to thank you not only for the conversation, but the work that you do. You over the years have really contributed a lot to the betterment of the lives of people at work, and maybe in general, just beyond the workplace as well, in developing that appreciation and self-understanding that has particularly been meaningful to introverts who may in the past have been afraid to own that for fear that it's some kind of a pejorative, when in fact it can be a strength as well. And you've shown that very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And little by little, we make a difference. So thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you found value, please do share it with others and consider a review on Apple Podcasts.